From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. A new blood test may drastically change how doctors treat depression. NeuroCare's chief medical officer, Dr. Justin Coffey, explains how a new test can identify the right antidepressant for each patient in weeks rather than months, making a major leap for prescription psychiatry.
And then Scott has a conversation with Dr. Kathleen Jones of Jet Propulsion Lab. She reveals how NASA's NISAR satellite can now scan the Earth in incredible detail, allowing us to see it breathe and shift in real time. What is NISAR? Well, it's a joint effort between NASA and ISRO, which is India's version of NASA, and it's the Synthetic Aperture Radar. That's that lovely acronym, NISAR. Stay tuned. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Imagine being diagnosed with depression and knowing it could take more than a year of trial and error just to find the right medication. Currently, it can take anywhere from 12 to 18 months to dial in the appropriate medication.
Our guest today is Dr. Justin Coffey, Chief Medical Officer at NeuroCare. He's here to discuss BrightCare, a novel platform leveraging neuroscience, data analytics, and clinical insights to transform brain health and care delivery.
We'll explore the science behind BrightCare and a new blood test that can shorten the time dramatically to get the right medication. We'll explore how it integrates with clinical practice and its implications for the future of mental health technology. Dr. Justin Coffey, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be with you this morning.
Well, this really caught my eye, I have to tell you, because I have known people whose frustration and then frustration while experiencing symptoms of depression has just been Herculean when they're trying to get a diagnosis. Why does it take so long to find the right medication? And you have to go, what, like a couple of months taking one medication before you know if it's going to work?
You're absolutely right. And that time period is just painful, right? Because the individual with depression continues to suffer during that time. The key issue is that identifying the right medicine or the optimal medicine for a specific individual can take several months. And that's because antidepressant medicines typically do not work right away. A given medication at a given dose needs, you know, several weeks to become fully effective, which means both the patients and the provider need to wait and observe during that period to see if the medicine at that dose is going to be helpful. If not, then the dose gets increased. That pattern repeats itself until the maximum dose is reached. If there is still inadequate benefit, or if the medication's side effects become problematic, then a different medicine is tried and the cycle starts over again. The trial and error approach is reality today, and it's one of the most frustrating challenges in the field, not only for the poor patient and his or her family and loved ones, but for the members of the care team as well, who you know, wish that there were a better way.
Wow, it's like adding insult to injury, isn't it? The fact that you're dealing with depression and then not getting the right medication. Now, there are varying severities and types of depression, mild and major. Does it matter what type or severity you have that is determining the length that it takes to get the right medication?
You're absolutely right. There are, we think, different kinds of depression out there. And not only do those different types of depression respond differently to different treatments, but within each kind of depression, the individual who's experiencing that depression is a unique individual with his or her own unique biology, his or her own unique psychology, and his or her own unique social environment. And so it makes it really, really tough to identify what the optimal treatment for a given person at a given time is going to be. And this is no small issue. You know, 300 million people across the globe are experiencing some form of depression at a given time. In the U.S., the rates of depression have, of course, gone up in recent years, perhaps in relation to the pandemic, perhaps in relation to the state of the world today. But almost 30% of Americans at any point in time are experiencing some form of depression. So as you described at the outset, this is probably something that's familiar to at least some portion of our listeners today.
30%. That sounds almost epidemic.
Absolutely. If there has been some silver lining to the COVID-19 pandemic, in my opinion, it's that maybe there is more conversation about the importance of mental health in our country today. That conversation taking place at national and regional and state levels, but also at schools, on the soccer field on Saturday mornings, and at the dinner table.
I want to stay on this for just a second because I'm fascinated by the ability of the medical community to diagnose depression. And we are talking, I guess, about a spectrum of depression from mild to, as we say, major. Now, if I break my arm, I can go to the ER, they'll take a CAT scan or an X-ray, and I know immediately, or the medical community knows immediately, what I have and how to treat it. What are the protocols for diagnosing somebody with depression and where they land on that spectrum?
Yeah, it's a very important question. Many diagnoses that we make in medicine today are what we call clinical diagnoses. We use the patient's history. We use certain diagnostic information that comes either from our examination of the patient or from diagnostic tests like the ones you mentioned, X-rays, blood tests, et cetera. And we put all that information together to see if what we know to be a certain kind of pattern recognition can unfold. So in that sense, the diagnosis of depression is really not very different from diagnosing pneumonia. But one thing that's different is that we don't have a blood test for depression. We don't have an X-ray for depression. And so in our kind of modern Western way of thinking about diseases and medical conditions, it's hard, or it can be hard, to see depression in common diagnostic tests. But on the other hand, we know a lot about what happens in the brain when that person is experiencing depression. We know a lot about how the circuitry in the brain that modulates our moods and our emotional experiences can go haywire when the brain is experiencing a depression. It's not as easy to see as, oh, my blood sugar is high or my blood sugar is low. But we are learning so much more through modern neuroscience, and that's helping us develop really exciting new technologies in the treatment area, like the Bright Care test.
Wow. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Justin Coffey. He holds board certifications in psychiatry, behavioral neurology, and neuropsychiatry, along with clinical informatics. And he is the chief medical officer at a company called NeuroCare. I have to spell that and then ask you about that. It's neuro, like N-E-U-R-O, and care is spelled K-A-I-R-E. What's the name about? What's the care misspelled about?
I think you see this a lot these days as a way to have a more unique moniker. NeuroCare is such an impressive company. It is and was founded and is led by two women scientists. And there are so many companies in the health and health technology and health sciences space today that are founded by women, led by women, and they're doing amazing, amazing things. I'm incredibly privileged to be the chief medical advisor of NeuroCare, where I get to help them think about the amazing clinical applications of the technology that they're developing.
All right. Well, we're talking to you about this new blood test that can help
zero in on a medication in as few as 6 weeks for depression. As many people who are listening probably know, as you've said, 30% of people out there who've been through this process and know that it can take a year and a half, and it's excruciating, I would imagine. Okay, what is it about testing your blood? What elements, what components of our blood should show better what we need as medication, and why haven't those shown up before? Why has there been no test until this point?
There have been lots of people and lots of laboratories all over the world trying to develop such a test. The NeuroCare team is the first, and it really is a game changer, especially for those folks that know the suffering that comes with depression. The test is, from the patient's perspective, very simple. It's a simple blood sample, no different than if we were taking a sample of your blood to test for diabetes or your potassium levels or for an infection. In the laboratory, it's a very sophisticated and exciting new type of technology that's being applied to that blood. What happens in the lab is that blood sample is used to create what we'll call a brain in a dish. We take those blood cells, we induce a state called pluripotency, which is a fancy scientist word for cells, stem cells, that have the capability to develop into many different types of cell lines. And by doing that, we can create neurons, brain cells, specific to that individual. It's those neurons in the dish that are so powerful, because what we do next is we expose those neurons to dozens of different medications. And we measure what exactly is happening to the neurons that helps us understand whether those neurons are, if you will, responding to the medication. So that's how this amazing test works. The outcome of this test is a very simple to understand report that is shared with not only the patient, but the patient's care team. And the report gives clear recommendations of among the dozens of antidepressants out there, all of which are, by the way, safe and effective, which one is more likely to work for this individual's depression at this point in time, using their own brain cells. Never before have we seen something like this.
A brain in a dish. That is amazing. Dr. Coffey, does the patient have to be off of all medications prior to this blood test, or can they be on a medication? I would imagine if they're on a medication, it might affect the way the neurons are growing in the Petri dish.
It's a terrific question. The good news is that it is safe and effective for the patient to be on whatever medicines that they're taking at the time. There's two reasons for that. Number one, from the patient's perspective, they might be on an antidepressant medicine that might not be working sufficiently, but it might be offering some benefit. And we probably don't want to take that benefit, no matter how small, away from the patient, who is already suffering and may have been suffering for months, if not years. The second thing, though, is technologically, we have a proprietary AI platform that we use to perform the analysis of the individual neurons' responses or not to the various medications that we expose it to. And that platform allows us to, if you will, control for these kinds of conditions, like if the patient is currently taking some form of medication.
I would imagine that with so many people experiencing depression globally, and of course here in the United States, that there could be quite a demand for this blood test. And I can only imagine that it's very time intensive growing neurons in a Petri dish, a brain in a dish, and the demand that we will probably see for this type of technology. Is there any role for artificial intelligence or other types of neuroscience to play in helping the diagnosis and treatment when we're trying to figure out the right either medication or cocktail of medications that will be the most appropriate for a patient moving forward?
We certainly hope so. And in fact, the promise of that kind of improvement, a major improvement, a leap forward in the care of individuals with depression, is really the raison d'etre of NeuroCare as a company. When we first developed this technology, it took longer for us to run these tests in our laboratories than it does today. Today, it's about an 8-week turnaround time from the time the patient gives us the blood sample to the time that he or she and their doctor get the report. We anticipate having that time down to 6 weeks in the near future, and hopefully even faster after that. That really pales in comparison to the months, sometimes years, that it can take individuals to find, you know, the right medication. And I'll tell you what's super exciting to me as a clinical neuroscientist is depression is just the beginning. This technology, the brain in a dish, it's not specific to depression. We can take those neurons in the dish. We can expose them to medicines for anxiety, medicines for schizophrenia, medicines for Parkinson's disease, medicines for you name the neurologic or psychiatric condition. And so we're really, really excited not only about what we've just launched for the depression world, but where we think this technology can impact so much of the very, very common debilitating conditions that are really pervasive throughout our society today.
This is just so exciting and so unbelievable. And, you know, we recently talked to someone who does a lot of reporting on, you know, growing new organs and where we are in biotech to, you know, grow a new kidney or, you know, various other organs. And it's just really incredible, Dr. Coffey. I'm just wondering what, in the bioethical world, are there any considerations within what NeuroCare is doing for, as you say, and I know it's not growing a brain in a petri dish. I know that that's just a way for us to picture it. But, you know, where are you on that frame of things?
Thank you so much for that question. Just on a personal note, it means a lot to me. I first realized I wanted to become a doctor when I was an undergraduate first studying biomedical ethics. And so it is a very, very important question, the one that you're asking. You're right. We are not growing a human being in the laboratory. This is not Frankenstein or anything close to it. But the technology is so powerful that we absolutely need to understand the ethical considerations of pursuing and deploying the technology. We need to think very carefully and deliberately, not only within the medical community, but with other key stakeholders in society about how to do this kind of clinical work and science responsibly, transparently, and if I'm being really honest, affordably these days, because there is no doubt that healthcare costs are out of control, especially in our country. And so a really neat, powerful technology that most people cannot afford to access doesn't really help us achieve our mission of relieving suffering. So it's a really, really important set of issues. The NeuroCare team has spent lots of time making sure we're doing things the right way. And we really would like to be part of the ongoing conversation about how appropriately and ethically to be using stem cell and stem cell technology.
Very interesting. How about the regulatory approval phase? Where are you with this test?
Well, we are live in the U.S. The test has been approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. It's a specific kind of test that's been developed in a specific laboratory, and so it is not under the regulation of FDA. Nevertheless, we think that there is value in pursuing FDA approval, and that will be underway. But the test is live, and you can order it. And if you're someone who is receiving Medicare, the test will be covered. So we're very, very excited by what's available now to the individuals in this country experiencing depression.
This is incredible. I am so excited about the future of Bright Care. And beyond depression, as you were mentioning, there could be other neurological situations that we could apply this technology to. I guess I would love to know what excites you the most right now about the future of neuroscience and digital health, and where does Bright Care fit into that future?
Well, the brain is the final frontier of modern medicine, in my opinion. And it's such an exciting time to be a part of this field, because the last 30, 40 years have brought incredible advances in the neurosciences. Today, we see incredible advances in technology, and especially health technology. You mentioned AI already this morning. And as we talked about before, there's so much more conversation, including and maybe even especially among young people, about the importance of mental health and wellness. What excites me is that these three streams, I hope, are converging, where the science, the technology, and the social discourse about this important issue of mental health and well-being takes place and develops a whole new approach to the way that we think about and mental health conditions, and how we care for one another when any of us is suffering from one of them.
This is going to be an incredible tool for clinicians, just like the x-ray was for the broken arm example earlier. Do you think that this will replace clinical diagnosis in the future, or is it simply going to be another tool that the clinician can use to help patients with their appropriate medical care?
You're making an important distinction, which we should highlight, and that is the Bright Care test is all about creating a therapeutic profile of the antidepressant medications. It is not a diagnostic test. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell us whether the person does or does not have depression. That is made by the clinician. So you could imagine the Bright Care test being applied in the same way that a blood sugar test is applied. I can have my blood sugar checked, but if I don't have diabetes, the information is not necessarily going to be informative. What Bright Care can do is, in someone who's received a proper diagnosis of depression, it can tell us which medicine is more likely to relieve their suffering. And that's what we do not have today. The trial and error approach that we've talked about is long, it's painful. There are costs not only to the individual, there are costs to the healthcare system. Because what happens when, as a psychiatrist, I'm trying to treat an individual with depression, instead of taking 4 weeks or 6 weeks to find the optimal medicine, it takes me 2 years. Well, now I've got an even longer wait list, right? And so now I need to rely more on the primary care providers to do more of the depression care in this country. Well, what do they need to do this? Well, then now they need 18 months, 2 years to come up with their own process. So you see how this has a domino effect. And then there's a societal cost when the health insurance companies know that there's this much of a lag, their costs for providing all the care go up. And what happens when the insurer's costs go up? Well, the cost to all of us in society, goes up. So we hope that these kinds of therapeutic tests can reduce the time for an individual patient, but also have big improvements in the efficiency of the overall healthcare system and hopefully in the overall affordability to our society.
Yeah, wow. Dr. Coffey, because we are not at Cool Science Radio in the business of promoting any one product over another, I'm wondering how many companies have this technology? And, you know, if I am a patient and I go in and I say to my primary care doctor, I have heard about a new blood test that can more quickly determine which medication will work for me. Are they going to know? Is that doctor going to know what I'm talking about? Are there many companies doing this?
We are not aware of anybody doing what we are doing. That said, the idea of using stem cells and stem cell technology in innovative ways to help patients in ways that we haven't been able to help them before, that is a very, very exciting wave of modern medicine. It's taking place in amazing degrees in the cancer space, among other spaces. But developing an individual's neurons from a blood sample is something that we are the only ones doing. There are tests available today that may sound like what we're doing at NeuroCare, but they are different, and maybe it would be helpful if I explain that difference. There are some blood tests today that create not a therapeutic profile for the individual with depression, but a metabolic profile. What that means is with my blood sample, a test can be run to determine how my body metabolizes certain antidepressant medications. Does my body metabolize this medicine faster or slower than the average person, for example? That has some clinical value in the sense that it might give my doctor a sense of whether I'm more or less likely to have maybe some side effects from this antidepressant versus that one. But the metabolic profile does not tell my doctor anything about whether this antidepressant is more or less likely to work for me. That's what's so different about the therapeutic profile that we've created with the BrightCare test at NeuroCare.
Wow, it'll be interesting to follow this technology and see where it goes. We've been speaking with Dr. Justin Coffey. He is board-certified psychiatrist, board-certified in behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry, and he is the chief medical officer at NeuroCare. Wow, it's a brave new world out there, isn't it? And one that can be really promising for all patients who suffer depressive symptoms. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Coffey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio, where we dive into discoveries and technologies shaping our future. And if we can understand it, so could you. I'm Scott Greenberg, and today we're joined by Dr. Kathleen Jones, the applications lead for NASA's groundbreaking NISAR mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Now, NISAR, it's short for NASA ISRO, Synthetic Aperture Radar, and it's a joint mission with India that will map nearly the entire Earth's surface every 12 days. From tracking changes in glaciers and forests to monitoring earthquakes, floods, and even agricultural patterns, NISAR promises to transform how we understand our dynamic planet. We're thrilled to have Dr. Jones with us to share how this mission will help scientists, decision makers, and communities around the world. Dr. Jones, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
Wow, this is really exciting. This is kind of a first of its kind satellite that's going to observe the Earth, the entire Earth, every 12 days.
Yes, it will. It actually will observe every place on the land twice every 12 days, because it's 12 days on the ascending orbit and 12 days on the descending orbit. And so twice in 12 days.
Okay. Can you explain for our listeners what an ascending orbit and a descending orbit is?
Well, the satellite goes around the Earth, and whenever it goes over California, where I am, it'll go over whenever it's moving up towards the North Pole, and then roughly 6 days later, it'll do it whenever it's moving down towards the South Pole.
So why is this such a big deal for Earth science?
Oh, why? So this particular mission uses a radar that is really good at seeing below vegetation. So you can measure things like flooding below vegetation, and you can measure what's happening on the ground below vegetation. So, you know, a lot of places on the Earth have a lot of vegetation, but they also might have a landslide that's, you know, ground that's moving. And so being able to see below that vegetation is really important.
I understand that the project uses synthetic aperture radar, which sounds pretty technical. And I think that's what we're actually talking about now, can see below the vegetation. Could you explain in plain language how this radar from space works and what makes it so powerful?
First of all, let me explain what synthetic aperture radar means. So, the longer your antenna, the narrower your beam and the finer resolution you get. But of course, you can't go and put a 1 mile long, you know, radar into space. So instead, what people do is they track, you know, the pulses very, very accurately as it moves across the land, and they synthesize a huge long antenna. And that's why it's synthetic. And aperture just means the size of the radar.
So I understand the NISAR is a collaboration between NASA and ISRO. That's India's space agency. How did this partnership come about and what makes it so unique?
Well, this is the first time that NASA has collaborated with India on this kind of mission, a huge, you know, flagship Earth science mission. NASA and ISRO are equal partners in this, you know, of course, we're equal partners in this. And NASA supplying one radar and ISRO's supplying a slightly different radar. And if you combine those two sets of images, then you get a lot more information about the ground than you would get from one alone.
So I understand that one of NISAR's major goals is to track subtle changes on Earth's surface. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, down to the centimeter. Can you talk about some of the changes it'll be tracking, including, by the way, maybe the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake, which is something we're particularly concerned about in our area.
Yeah, so NISAR uses something called interferometry to look at changes over time. So it'll measure one time, get an image, and the second time it gets the image, it'll do a comparison sort of at the radar wavelength level so that it can tell whether the surface has moved. So, for example, if you have a creeping landslide and it's moved a centimeter, so a half an inch in that 12 days, you'll be able to see that that movement. And lots of things are moving. I mean, you know, you have subsidence from groundwater withdrawal, you have just normal subsidence, you have subsidence from permafrost thaw, you have sinkholes. So having this ability to measure very small changes in the position of the Earth's surface is really important. And you also can use the same technology to measure flood water levels below vegetation.
Wow. And I assume you can also measure volcanic activities and earthquakes and all sorts of things from this.
Exactly.
So this sounds like a massive amount of data that you're collecting. Now, I'm kind of wondering, first of all, how does it get computed? I mean, you must be using massive computers for the amount of data that you're collecting. And then how will you be sharing to help communities around the world?
Yeah, I think I have this right. I think it's 35 terabits of data per day. And that gets, yes, I see your face. Yeah, terabits of data a day. And so the team has worked for years to make sure that they can process all that data into its products in one day, because the next day they're getting another 35 terabits.
Yes, the look on my face, and fortunately, this is just audio because I'm gobsmacked by the amount of data that this is going to be producing per day. But again, how are we going to be disseminating this information back out to communities, and how will they be using it?
Yeah, we take that raw data and generate image products, and we generate these products that show the surface deformation for every scene that we collect. And all of that is going to be openly available. It's going to be on a portal where people can download it and access it and view it. So free and open data, that's NASA's policy. But also, we're going to take it and use it to put out a soil moisture map. Every 12 days, you'll get a new soil moisture map so that you can look at how things are changing for agriculture, for, you know, hazards, things like landslides that are activated by soil moisture in some cases. And in addition, we've been working with a lot of the agencies so that they're aware of this data that's coming out and are being trained to be able to use the data. And many agencies already use this type of data. So
this is going to be used, I assume, to track climate change. I mean, in addition to the moisture levels that you're looking at, the whether the sea is rising or falling in particular areas or glacier melt, I've got to believe that we're looking at overall climate change, which can also be used to support agricultural forecasts and maybe even provide some additional food security?
Definitely. Those applications are very important for NICER. I do want to clarify one thing. We're not actually looking at sea level rise or at climate change. We don't measure sea level rise itself. But a lot of the consequences of, you know, things that are happening on the ground, fires and soil moisture changes and changes in surface elevation from groundwater withdrawal. Also, groundwater recharge. You can also see changes in the surface elevation from places where people are implementing groundwater recharge projects. So a lot of things are, ancillary information that's just super, you know, useful to people. You want to know what the conditions of your crops are. You want to know what the soil moisture is. It's all very useful information.
How long ago did this project start?
You know, long before me. It was about 30 years ago that people started trying to get this funded. So it's been in the works for a long time.
Wow. And when did it become a reality? And when did the satellite engineering start?
I don't know exactly when. I would have to find out that for you. I know it was around 2010, but I'm not sure exactly.
But it's been in the works for a while.
Yeah.
And when did this launch, or has it launched yet?
Oh, yeah, it launched. It launched at the end of July from India, and it's now on orbit. It's being moved into its final science orbit. And then they'll start commissioning the instrument, and data will be available in a few months.
Okay, so you think maybe by the end of the year it'll be up and running?
So, I hope so.
This is incredible. I mean, we've talked about these two different radar systems that we're doing and how it can track the entire Earth's surface every 12 days. And as you said, up for 6 days and down for 6 days, which is kind of cool. But of all of this that's going on, personally for you, what do you think is the most exciting technological or scientific breakthrough that NASA represents?
You know, there are so many cool things that this is going to do that it's hard to pick out my favorite. But my favorite is...
pick out three.
My favorite is this ability to measure changes in the location of the Earth's surface, and you know how areas move and subside at sort of the sub-inch level, sort of centimeter to, if you track it for 3 years, you might be able to get 2 or 3 millimeters per year of motion. Really startlingly accurate amounts of measurements of changes in the Earth's surface. And think about all of the things that might be changing that, you know, at a very small level, your eye's never going to be able to see subsidence at that level across many, many acres, a huge area. But this instrument can. This can tell you.
You know, so many of our latest space projects, for lack of a better term, have been really looking out into the cosmos. I think about Hubble, James Webb Telescope, the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, which just came online in Chile. What do you think was the motivation to have a satellite system looking back at us?
What's really important is to know the conditions that are currently normal and the conditions that indicate change. And change can be good, change can be bad, but really knowing when something is changing is really important. And, you know, that's true on the Earth, and sometimes having this, you know, it's beyond eagle eye view, you know, it's satellite view, synoptic view of what's happening across the whole land surface at one time. I mean, imagine if you're able to look at what's going on in the Amazon at the same time as you're looking at what's going on in the cryosphere in Alaska, in those areas, northern Canada. This gives you a different view of what's happening across the planet.
Is there anything that I've left out that you want to discuss regarding this mission that you feel is really important for our listeners to understand why this is so important?
Well, I think that it's important to understand just the scope of all of the things that can be done with this instrument. You can look at ecosystems. Now, ecosystems is broad in and of itself, you know, agriculture, forests, wetlands, conditions in urban areas, urban forestation, you know, forestry in urban areas. And that's just one of the applications areas. You also have things like the solid earth issues that deal with this earth movement, like earthquakes, landslides, volcanoes. At the same time, you can look at the cryosphere, and then you can put all of those things together for disaster response and disaster mitigation and disaster avoidance, actually, you know, knowing where problems are occurring before they occur across broad, broad area of applications.
Are there specific gaps in Earth science that maybe our understanding is a little weakened that hopefully this project is going to help scientists solve some mysteries?
I think that one, striking advantage of this mission is the particular radar frequency that it's operating out and giving. It's the kind of radar that sees through vegetation better than the ones that are out there that provide, you know, global coverage right now at a rapid rate. And so you get much better information about surface deformation. The other thing is really much better at is getting biomass. So understanding how much biomass there is in forests around the world.
So I'm going to ask a silly question, but what is biomass?
It's wood.
It's wood. Well, that's a very simple answer. The biomass is wood. So we've been actually talking about
pretty much. I'm gonna get in trouble for saying that, but that's pretty
just wood. Well, we could certainly edit that out, but I think I'm gonna leave it in. Yeah. If you're just joining us, we've been talking to Dr. Kathleen Jones, the application lead for NASA's groundbreaking NISAR mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Now, NISAR is short for NASA ISRO, Synthetic Aperture Radar, and it's a joint mission between NASA and India. And it's going to map the entire Earth roughly every 12 days. It's absolutely fascinating. Now, we've been talking pretty much technically about looking at the Earth from this wonderful new satellite and the new technologies. But I'm going to actually turn the satellite on you, Dr. Jones, just a moment. I am curious. You've spent much of your career studying Earth from space. What first inspired you personally to become a scientist, and how did that path lead you to this NYSAR project?
Well, I think I was born wanting to be a scientist. I've always said, you know, how does this work? How does that work? That's just me from the very beginning. And I really liked math. Math was my favorite subject. So I was just destined for this career. But how did I get into earth science? I think I love the technology, and I actually started with a system engineer on the radar, and then I realized just how useful it was and started really trying to make sure that this powerful instrument for science would be adopted for applications and help to help people.
Well, you say you got into this. I hope I'm going to embarrass you a little bit because your resume is unbelievable. I know you have a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Texas A&M, and then you went on to get a Master's of Science in Physics and your PhD in Physics from the California Institute of Technology, which, come on, that's incredibly impressive. And, I'm not going to say the dates of your degrees, because you look much younger than this could possibly be. You must have gone to college when you were 12 years old. This is incredible. My one last question, I'd love to wrap up. I would love to know, every mission has a magical moment. I assume every mission has this magical moment when the very first data comes back. What are you personally most excited about when you see the NYSAR start sending images of our planet back to Earth?
I think I'm going to be excited to look at the resolution and the field boundaries on agricultural areas, and then look at the interferograms over volcanoes and over some of the earthquake faults where you can see slip. And I'm also, I love California, so I'm very interested in looking at things in the Central Valley and in the Sacramento Delta. That's really what I'd like to do.
So a little bit of a personal journey here, I assume.
Yes.
Okay. And what role, do you have a counterpart in India who's also going to be studying this data?
Yeah, India has their own science team, and they are very interested in some of the ecosystems. In particular, agriculture is very, very important to them. Disaster response is important, and they have a lot of landslide problems. So they have experts in India on all of these topics.
This just sounds so exciting. It's so wonderful to hear that in addition to our scientists looking out into the cosmos, we've also turned an eye back on our own planet. Our guest today is Dr. Kathleen Jones, applications lead for NASA's NYSAR mission at JPL NYSAR. The mission will deliver an unprecedented look at Earth's changing ecosystems, hazards, and climate. And as we've heard today, its data will be invaluable not only to researchers, but to communities around the world who rely on accurate information to prepare for and respond to a changing planet. You can learn more about the mission at NASA's NYSAR website. Dr. Jones, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio today.
Wonderful to talk to you.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Hey, we have just a moment remaining, a few minutes remaining, in which we can talk about the science of truffle hunting. Okay, my co-host here, Scott Greenberg, just got back from truffle hunting in Italy. And I want to know about it, so we're going to turn it into a very short science-y conversation. Okay. Yeah.
Come stai, Lindwehr Peak? Come stai?
Sto molto bene, grazie. So truffle hunting is all about taking a dog. They used to take pigs, but they take
pigs. Yeah, now it's dogs.
Yeah, why? Do you know why that is?
Absolutely, the pigs would eat the truffles. They couldn't get the truffles out of the pig's mouth fast enough.
So, interesting. Yeah. Okay, and so they take dogs, and the dogs don't like to eat the truffles.
Oh, they will, but they're trained not to. If left unguarded, they'll go for them. Truffles are delicious. Now, by the way, I should probably mention these are white truffles, very short season in the northern part of Italy. This was in the Piemonte region in Alba.
So. Okay, and how deeply buried are the truffles? How difficult is it for a dog to find one?
You know, it's a good question. They're generally somewhere between 6 and 12 inches under the ground and clinging to a root of a particular type of tree. I always thought it was just the oak tree, but we learned that the truffles in Alba, these beautiful, gorgeous, very expensive white truffles, actually grow on several different types of roots of trees in the forest. And the dogs, by the way, fascinating. They teach the dogs how to hunt for truffles, not actually by smelling truffles, but initially gorgonzola cheese.
Wow.
I don't know why.
They bury a hunk of gorgonzola?
Exactly.
And then send them around. Well, gorgonzola is so odoriferous.
Yes, it's odoriferous.
We might say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we had the privilege of going out with a farmer and his dog through the forest hunting truffles last week, and it was fascinating.
Did you have to run through the forest and overland it, bushwhack and all that?
No, not quite. I mean, the dog is very energetic, but he stops quite often to either sniff or relieve himself, so you can catch up with him.
Right. Oh, that sounds so wonderful. Okay, I'll have to hear more.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode, as well as past episodes, on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.
If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.